Is it a step below knighthood? You know,
yeah. Being a bloke.
Being a bloke.
I think so. Actually, might be a step. I think it's a step above.
Because you can get knighted. Can you get bloked?
Scotch shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 109 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I've forgotten how to program.
I'm Sam, and I do art.
And today is August 1th, 2017. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show. Mostly by that, I mean we're going to be swearing. So if you don't like bad words, then get your keister out of here.
Could it also have been August worst?
Yeah.
Does that work too?
Yeah.
Is that like okay. A brat?
Yeah.
Delicious. August worst. And then, of course, August best is, well, it's the end of August.
Bestest.
Yeah. Yeah, because as you progress through August, it just gets better.
It just gets better. Yeah, that's fair. Actually, I mean, given the heat outside, it's probably true.
Yeah, August worst. All right, so we got some news this week. For starters, you may have noticed that in previous episodes, for the past 30 episodes or so, about once or twice per episode, you would hear a loud sort of gonging noise. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This kind of subsided recently. Because Fat Bard has gotten pretty aggressive about editing those out.
Well, and because Monique now listens to them ahead of time
and knows where and the gongs are. Them.
Yeah. That was us while wildly gesticulating, slapping our microphone stand.
And when you say us, is there anybody in particular? Who?
Probably mostly me.
Yeah, I think that's
right. Yeah. I'm probably about 90 to 95%.
Also, it says knee. You always just see his leg shaking, yeah. Kind of off your periff.
And then I got a lot of kinetic energy.
So often it pops the table.
And so Fat Bart sent us a message on Discord. He's like, listen, I'm going to come over there. I'm going to take a board. I'm going to drill it into your wall. And I'm going to attach your mics to hang from this board. And I was like, nah, man, this sounds like an undertaking. Let's just not worry about it. He's like, no, listen. If I got to spend 10 minutes every fucking week getting these gongs removed from your podcast, I'd rather just spend a half an hour now, drill a board to your wall, and just be done with it. So in theory, this problem is solved now.
We'll find out.
So we've just, like, our audio quality is just going to be at the next level. Also, this week, actually starting now, today, we are in the Yo-Yo Games bundle again. Yep. And this is, if you want to sort of dabble in game dev or check out Game Maker, now's the time. It's the Humble Bundle has teamed up with Yo-Yo Games and then a bunch of developers to do a release of Game Maker Studio plus a whole bunch of modules and then also a bunch of source code for games so you can kind of reverse engineer and try to figure out how they work. And our games are in there. We have Flop Rocket, Freeway Mutant, we have Shep Hard, and Extreme Burger Defense. Mm-hmm. So three of those were jam games that we put together, and then Flop Rocket is the fully released Flop Rocket that you can get on iOS and Android. So if you ever wanted to dig into the guts of our games, you can do that. And I think it's like $1,000 of software.
If you go, I think it's the full 15 bucks if you pay gets you the Flop Rocket source code and all of the Game Maker everything, basically.
Yeah.
And it's insane.
It's one of those deals of a lifetime, except it happened also last year. So
it is the older version of Game Maker, not Game Maker 2.
Correct. Yes, but a lot of people
to get it for $15
is insane.
Is if you feel like you have a right to complain, you're wrong.
You're wrong now.
You're wrong about that.
Yeah, and then Game Maker Studio is still being supported
until the
end of next year. Yeah. So there's still plenty of time to play around with it. And Game Maker 2 is pretty much the same as Game Maker Studio.
Right. Mostly an interface overhaul.
Yeah, it's easier to use, but there's not a lot of like fundamental sort of functional differences. So if you learn how to use Game Maker Studio, then that's going to carry over into Game Maker 2.
Yeah. And so if you think you want Game Maker Studio 2, but you're on the fence and you know the price tag seems a little high, just start with Game Maker.
Just get that
regular
bundle.
Game Maker Studio.
And you can convert Game Maker Studio projects over to Game Maker 2 directly. So, there's no losing here. There's no losing. And also, I put together a video. There's a walkthrough of our source code for Flop Rocket. And so that's just like linked on the main menu of the Flop Rocket thing. So you can actually have like a one-on-one jam sesh with yours truly. So that's cool. All right. So we also have coming up this upcoming weekend is Pixel Pop Festival, which we mentioned last week. It's a big sort of like gaming, game dev convention thing here in St. Louis. This is the fourth year running. And we have Adam's going to be giving a talk about decision making. Mm-hmm. The talk is called Thinking. It's harder than you think.
And it is. It's true.
Well, the joke we always have is that whenever Adam gives a talk, it inevitably makes everybody have a sort of vague existential dread.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And I think this one's going to deliver.
I think this one's going to do it.
In a good way.
But it is funny, though, because it is now just the way that I think about stuff and that actually kind of in the office now, like, you know, we've been driving everybody to think in the same way. And so I got to the end of putting this talk together yesterday or 2 days ago. And so I'm looking at what I've put together. And I'm like, I think this is going to freak some people out,
probably.
But I also wasn't really sure because, like, I got freaked out by this shit a long time ago, and I can't remember what it feels like. Because
now you just live in it. Yeah, you live in the darkness.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's gonna be an interesting one.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're around on Saturday, I think it's at 3 p.m. on Saturday. And if you're not, then we actually have on our blog, we have a little email sign up. If you want to get just a direct email, a one-off email with the YouTube link, we'll be uploading it probably within a couple of days after the event is over. We're recording on our own equipment and stuff, so we'll be really on that, and it'll be live on the internet, so you can just come and watch it if you're too far away to come see us in
yes.
person. But the whole crew will be there, so if you're except in the surrounding area, except for Seth,
yeah,
the whole rest of the crew will be there. So if you're in the area, definitely come by. And then beyond that, as far as other guests go, our friends from Taco Illuminati, Sam Palvan, who made Ludi Dungeon, mm-hmm. is coming by. And so we got a panel with him on Sunday, I believe. Mm-hmm. They're screening the Dev Diary series, the Crashlands documentary, on Sunday evening as well. And then Monique is actually going to be in her first panel ever. Mm-hmm. So talking about the concept of work-life balance in games. And so we'll be doing a lot of different stuff, and the sort of headliner for the whole show, the keynote speaker, is Rebecca Saltzman, who is part of Finji, and they're working on Overland, and they also publish a couple of games. I think they just picked up that game Tunic, which is this super cute fox isometric game where you're like this adorable fox character with a sword stabbing stuff. So if you're interested in any of those people or, you know, streaming, game dev stuff, whatever, either come out or, I guess, pay attention to their general social media and YouTube stuff mm-hmm. whenever they put out.
There are two guests of honor. Mm-hmm. I'm not really 100% sure what that means, but Sam already has listed one of them. The other one is Aurelian?
Aurelian, yes.
Yeah. So Aurelian, a Twitch streamer, apparently.
Yeah, so she's really awesome. Seth and I actually met her a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. So she's a St. Louis native, and we met her, I think, when she was just kind of starting to blow up. And basically, mm-hmm. she plays Minecraft. And she's just super wonderful. And so everyone just loves watching her play Minecraft. And so she had sort of like more of like a kid-friendly sort of Let's Playing sort of channel, and ended up getting pulled on by Twitch to, I think she actually runs like a big part of their streaming stuff now. Like she's in charge of stuff at Twitch. And I think she was splitting time between here and LA for a while. And I have no idea. I haven't actually talked to her in a long time. So it'll be nice to catch up with her.
Yeah, she's one of those sort of infectious enthusiasm kinds of.
It must have been super hard to make a kid-friendly channel on Twitch, you know, that didn't, because people can just come into it, right?
Right. Well, I think she largely did YouTube and then
and then
got pulled on to Twitch, I believe. Not sure how exactly the trajectory goes. Be an interesting conversation, I'm sure, to see what that moderation of that community
must have been real tricky.
Yeah.
But she's great, so I'm really excited to see her again.
But yeah, so then that email newsletter, if you want to hear more about our talks and stuff, we have a bit.ly link, which is at bit.ly/bscotchtalkalert. So bscotchtalkalert.
Okay.
Taco.
All lowercase?
Yeah.
All lowercase. Okay. So you can put your name in there, and then just if you want to get notified in the future about when we're giving talks and where and stuff like that, then you can get that. So that's all that's happening with sort of events and stuff. A lot of cool things happening. And then we've got one final news item, which is we need to talk about Vicarious Goal Fulfillment.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this.
So I read a book this past week, and the book touched on a bunch of different interesting psychological concepts. And one of them was this idea.
What book was it?
The book is called Hitmakers.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. So, because of course we're trying to make hits with our stuff. So I was like, maybe I should read a book about this.
Also, I saw you hit your microphone.
I just hit the wire.
Sorry, he hit the cord. Is that?
I think we're good. There's no gong. So But the
quit book swinging is called, your arms around. Jeez.
The book is called Hitmakers. It's a very recent book, which is nice because it takes into account a lot of the basically a lot of the more recent phenomenons. And so it's a lot of the older books about either popularity science or whatever else. I mean, they're just older, like a decade older, which kind of is out of pace with where everything's mm-hmm. gone to now. So one of the ideas that they touched on sort of as an aside was this story about how McDonald's in 2014 introduced a suite of healthy food items to their menu. So you're talking like salads. I don't even know what else.
Probably just salads. Probably just salads.
Like, salads, we put lettuce leaves wraps, on it.
They put a suite of one item yeah. right. on it.
So, yeah. A variety of salads. So, and interestingly, they had one of their best years ever, apparently, according to this book. And when they went back and looked at the data for what people actually bought, though, people bought more hamburgers. So in other words, more people showed up, but then just instead just of buying a salad, just bought hamburgers. And so this leads into this overall story and this concept of what's called vicarious goal fulfillment. And this has been talked about sometimes in goal setting literature a little bit. And if you've looked into any sort of self-improvement stuff, you've probably heard it around where it's this idea that if you're not careful, if you tell other people a lot about like the thing that you're going to do, it's in some ways your brain's like, I kind of already did that.
Well, you've gotten the social benefit.
Exactly.
Right. So if you go, oh yeah, I'm going to run to McDonald's and grab lunch. And somebody's like, why are you going to McDonald's? They just have garbage food. And you're like, no, they have salads now. And
yeah.
The other person's like, oh, and then you just go there and buy a burger.
Well, so the interesting thing about it is that I think the really insidious and weird thing about vicarious goal fulfillment is that this one doesn't even require that you tell anybody. This is literally
just thinking about it.
If you think about doing something that's good, then it kind of allows you to indulge.
I thought about getting a salad, so I earned that burger.
That's right. And apparently this is a real thing. I can't think of any particular instance for myself recently where I've done it, but
I mean, it is a hard thing. It's hard for me to believe that that's actually what's happening because there are so many other, because I think Seth's explanation was actually not that at all, but right. also sounded super reasonable for why right. that happened. Right? and especially where, because if instead now when you think of McDonald's, you don't think unhealthy grease trap, which is like right. normally what you think about, right? But if now all of a sudden all this stuff is like, look at all these salads and shit, right? Then now when you think of McDonald's, you think like, yeah, pretty unhealthy, but maybe not like grease trap now, right? Like you kind of,
because the bar's gone up
a bit.
There.
Yeah, there's a salad in there and it's in your brain a little bit. And so now when you're trying to decide like where to go eat, it now just, it just seems less it's, like a bad option.
It's elevated. Yeah. Because what you're buying there is also just like the idea right. of eating at McDonald's. Right.
So now it makes going there easier, but it actually wasn't that you were going to buy a salad there ever. It was actually
more socially acceptable for you to
exactly.
go. Interesting. Well, so this leads actually interestingly to another sort of a segue to another thing we've talked about in previous episodes a few times, which is that classic marshmallow experiment with willpower. Mm-hmm. So just to recap, the idea was that, and this has been quoted a ton, you'll see there's a bunch of willpower research flying around the internet. But basically what it comes down to is people put kids in a room with either a marshmallow or a cookie on a plate. And then they're like, if you wait, then we'll give you another one. But if you eat it, then
that's all you get.
And then they just measured how long kids can sort of like hold out. And then also looked at some of their methods for holding out. And then essentially tracked those kids throughout their lives and found that it's a good predictor of their overall success in school and then in careers and stuff, how long they're able to.
Basically, people who can think in the long term and resist
right.
short-term rewards.
I have a fun alternative explanation.
Well, so here it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's well, I guess here you tell me yours.
Mine's probably different than yours is, which okay. is that actual moment in time caused those kids. It was causative. So
it's an inflection point.
Inflection point. So the experimenters actually changed these kids' lives by setting up this experiment so that those kids who, you know, just couldn't help themselves in that moment and ate the cookie.
Now they're always looking back on that moment and they're like, I could have had two cookies.
Yeah. And it changed their entire life.
They just go into a depression and they just can't handle it.
Control the lives. I think this goes back to where Adam was talking about, you know, taking a second and looking at some other factors.
Always look at the alternative explanations.
So here's another one. So a follow-up study was somebody was like, I don't think this is right. Because they're like, there's another huge factor here, which is that there's an adult figure
yeah.
and a child figure.
Right.
And the adult figure is the one who's giving the treat. So they said, what if we take these adult figures and we basically sow some mistrust in terms of whether or not they'll be around before the kids actually go into this experiment. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they had the kids just like playing with toys. And then the experimenter would ask them if they wanted like a dinosaur toy or something like that. Kids, of course, would be like, fuck yeah.
Y'all want that dinosaur?
And the experimenter then would leave and sometimes would just come back and be like, oh, sorry, I forgot about it or something like that.
Right.
And then they do the willpower experiment. Guess how many kids eat just one cookie? Because
probably none of them.
All of them do because they don't trust.
Oh, they eat it right away.
Yeah, because they're like, well, the adult's not going to come back. So what they found is that it may actually be more a measure of essentially trust in the system, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
In your authority systems, generally speaking, which of course.
So if you're obedient, then you're going to succeed more.
Well, I mean, if you have more.
Of course, when success is defined
by your grades, or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. And I was like, whoa. So I read that and I thought.
And so it turns out actually all those other kids, the ones who weren't patient, went off and started their own company.
They all started Uber. Yeah, they and all now they're Uber. All in jail.
It was also interesting. So like, valedictorians are completely like unrepresented in when it comes to like startup founders and stuff like that for these multi-million.
Is that just statistical? Because there can only be one.
What do you mean?
Like you only get one valedictorian like per hundreds or thousands of people, depending on how big your school is.
Yeah, so, but there's a lot of schools.
There's a lot of schools. There's a lot of valedictorians.
That's true.
Apparently there's like 30 of them.
They're weirdly underrepresented in terms of the what you would assume based on their grade achievement.
Right.
But it turns out that they're just getting good grades.
Right.
Very different than doing risky shit. So.
Yeah. In retrospect.
It's a different value system.
In retrospect, my approach to grades was, I'm going to do them, but. I'm going to do grades, but if I don't get the A+, you know, that's okay. Because I'm going to help Adam build his trebuchet. Interesting. Uh-huh. There was another point you made from reading that book about virality, which I would like to also talk about a little bit.
Sure.
So hit us with that.
So interesting. So this book, he walks through sort of the question is, you know, why are things actually popular? What are some of the mechanics that are at work there? And then toward the end, he starts tackling this idea of virality. And what he finds out is sort of through all this research is that all the research that's been done about this idea that things spread in a one-to-one way, which is kind of what the idea of virality is. Like I learn about something, I tell Seth, Seth tells Adam tells his wife tells a friend, whatever.
People have a term for it. It's called the viral coefficient.
Right.
Where they're like, it's the
shareability.
Yeah. So if something has a viral coefficient of greater than one, or like greater than whatever.
I think it's just the number of people on average one person will share it with or something like that.
Yes. So it has to be past a certain threshold in order for it to actually spread.
Right.
But that is just an average.
Yeah.
It is.
You know, averages are as you're getting at, they don't really mean anything.
So, so as it turns out, when they've done a bunch of research actually tracking individual things that they've basically seeded into, you know, Twitter or whatever else, they found that the reality is that people actually don't share stuff very much. Or if they do, that it almost never gets beyond one share. Like you don't typically actually share something that someone shared to you. So what they found then, the question is like, well, what is this virality thing then? Because it doesn't exist in the way that we think it does, which is this many one-to-one transitions. And the way he starts talking about it is this idea of broadcasts. So the reality is that something that seems like it's viral is actually just hopping between these one-to-many points many times. So for example, you know, like Justin Bieber maybe tweets about some new artist or something like that with a new music video that they came out with. That is a huge one-to-many broadcast. One of those people that hits, because of course Justin Bieber's followed by literally like half the planet, might pick it up, or it might be someone who is on like the Ellen Show.
Someone who also has a big
network. Also has a huge broadcast. Mm-hmm. And then they'll pick it up and keep on doing it. And once those are done, then it's done. Like there's no, the idea of virality being like a sort of a grassroots democratic thing is actually, it's not true.
Well, and it's also the case that you see things like YouTube, for example. If you put up a YouTube video, and then one of these broadcasters sees it and blasts it out. There are algorithms in place to further ensure the success of that video, right? Because YouTube wants to show people stuff that people like, and part
so
of
you have
their
trending and all that.
Yeah, so part of their calculations, like they have trending videos, they have recommended videos, and so if like all of a sudden a video goes up and within the first week it has a million views, YouTube is like, oh shit, people are watching the shit out of this thing. I'm gonna pop this up the priority queue because it has a high velocity, right?
Right.
And so you get all these sort of algorithms working together to sort of further that effect, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those views are coming from, you know, Steve on Twitter being like, look at this video. And then his six followers are like, everybody look at this.
Right.
And then their six, you know, it's, it just doesn't go
like that. It
doesn't
actually go like that.
But also we know from our own conversion rate with, you know, tweets we put out and stuff that, you know, we have what, 27,000?
I think you said 20, 22?
20, so whatever, 1,000 followers, right? And if we tweet something, no matter what it is, our best case scenario is we get like 20 retweets, you know?
Right? Yeah. So if the idea is like for each person who sees it, they share it with like 1.5 people on average.
Right.
That would mean that, so, and when we put out a tweet, we get something like 2,000-3,000 just views yeah, of right. the tweet. That would mean that those people who see it, 3,000 of people who see it, we would end up with like, you know,
another chunk of those who would do
yeah. 4,000
who would pass it on.
Yeah. We'd end up with, yeah. So it's when really we end up with 20. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this idea is.
But if one of those 20 was somebody who then broadcasted to 50,000 or 100,000 right. or a
then we look
people.
At it and we go, look at this viral coefficient. Yeah. It's right. crazy.
It's usually actually coming from one or two sources is actually yeah. the truth. So,
yeah.
they compare so it's really it's the probability of hitting another broadcast network.
Correct. And they compare it in the book to the difference between virality and what's referred to in epidemiology as like your disease source, right? We're like, mm-hmm.
You need a vector.
You need a disease vector.
You need Justin Bieber to spread
you need a poisoned well. You know, you don't want the viral. You don't want like a cold. That's not what you want in terms of. That's not what you're actually making in terms of an idea that's spreading. You want a diseased well that everybody goes to get
drink
the water,
out of,
and that's yeah. it's perfect.
Oh, colds are pretty good at distributing themselves.
They are.
But ideas are not like colds, as it turns out.
So I thought that was a very interesting.
Good twist.
Take on it because you do often hear people talking about trying to make a viral video. And there's even like marketing firms that they advertise this as their thing. Like that mm-hmm. they know they understand virality and they can make products that people that are like shareable products, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a thing.
Well, what it probably means is they have a bunch of broadcasters on retainer.
Yep.
This is also with the whole rise of, you know, we've talked about it before, the rise of the sort of influencer network as far as, you know, Twitch streamers and YouTubers and stuff. You know, you can oftentimes, and I think we talked about this with even just our little mention that we got from Total Biscuit in his video, we saw a little bit of an uptick in terms of our sales of Crashlands on Steam mm-hmm. and more so than, probably not like statistically significant, but definitely there's something there. And then plenty of people have talked about how if they get, like they've shown some graphs where it shows that here's the day we got like Markiplier played our game and you can see the effect that comes from this, right? It's not about virality at that point. It's about something else entirely, which is just hitting something that these broadcasters want to broadcast.
But yeah, but interestingly, you know, you'll see those spikes and then it decays just like everything else.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to normal.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not like,
it's not like it
kicks off a round of virality and then all of a sudden it just starts growing forever.
Right.
It just continually decays because people only have so much attention. And everything's competing for it all the time.
So there's probably a virality between large broadcast networks.
Correct.
Right. So the more of those you can catch, then the bigger the overall audience you can get. But if it's not going through those, and actually it is kind of interesting because the language has changed recently too, because it used to be all about virality. But actually, I don't think I really hear that word ever anymore. But I do hear the word influencers all the time.
Yes.
And so I think
people are
kind
on.
Of aware of this, that actually that this is how the world is, right?
Mm-hmm. It's how it has always been.
Has always been. Yeah. We all got to have believe for one shining moment that actually we had some control. There were no gatekeepers, right?
Nah,
that's not true.
It's actually just shit little gatekeepers.
There's just a lot of them.
Small gardens.
We've democratized our gatekeeper system.
Right.
Now there's just a lot more of them.
Well, I think it comes into an interesting question with something like multiplayer. It's like PlayerUnknown's Battleground, for example.
Yeah.
Which I think is now the only non-Valve game to it had
the most concurrent players except for Valve games,
right?
Yeah, so it'd be,
but this started as a mod.
Started as a mod, and the guy built it as a full product. And it's a multiplayer battle arena. So you run around. It's like a battle royale. So you appear, you shoot people, you have teams, whatever. And it's a multiplayer game. So I think the interesting question here is how does multiplayer factor into this? Because, of course, if you are playing, so multiplayer seems to be the one place where you might actually have some form of this virality happen.
Right. Because you got to bring your 1.3 friends along with you.
You have to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's more fun if you do. So in that game.
But there's a question is how many people who play multiplayer games actually get on with convince a buddy to come buy the game and play it with them versus have an existing network that probably already has the game because the game was advertised really well.
Right.
And they just jump in and they just go play with those people or with random internet strangers.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know.
I think in my own experience, there is a game that I try to get everybody to buy and play, which is Rocket League.
Also Eve,
but I know that's a losing battle. but interestingly with Rocket League, people will buy it and try it, But it's also the case that it's such a high skill game that since I have several hundred hours in it and they are just starting, then we can't actually really play together.
Right.
Right. Like on the same level in any kind of a way. So we'll play together for like an hour and then they're like, hey, and then they just never play it again. So I don't know. It's kind of weird, but I have to wonder too about the effect of if you think about since PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds was a mod, what game was it a mod for?
I remember.
But the, like, the
I didn't even know it existed until like last week when all of a sudden all I heard about was this game.
This is the interesting thing. So they talk about this idea of a dark broadcast too, which is someone who actually, and I, you know, we talk about B-Scotch ID and our goals of B-Scotch ID, which really you should convert in your mind into the goal for us is to have our own broadcast where we can reliably, which means not Twitter, not Facebook, reliably reach out to a group of people who are interested in our stuff and who have opted in. And in that way, but this is something that no platform can see, right?
It's dark relative to what everybody else is doing.
And it's also dark to all developers, right?
Yep.
So it's just our thing. So when someone sees a successful, you know, inflection point for us, so for example, the launch of Crashlands onto Steam Greenlight took 48 hours. And we told everybody, we sent 4,000 emails or however many it was that day to a bunch of people who have signed up for our newsletter to tell them this was happening. And we got through in 42 hours. And we may have even gotten through faster, but it was a weekend, so no one at Valve was able to press the button. So who knows how fast that potentially could have gone, right?
Right.
And the interesting thing is people oftentimes when we talk to them about it, they're like, oh, wow, you got through Greenlight so fast. But they don't, like, we told them that we used our own network to do so. But they don't oftentimes attribute it to that so much as to
the trailer
or the strength of the game. Which, well,
even we did, right?
Yeah.
And we put a Gama Sutra article up about it.
Well, we talked about the trailer, right. But I think a big part of it is knowing that a lot of times what you see as a big success, like PlayerUnknown Battleground, already had a huge number of users. It came out of a mod community.
Exactly.
So it came from a successful game, which is a network, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, like a network or a broadcast being just like any place where there's a lot of people congregating who are receiving the same set of information, right? And if you have a community of people, of millions of people playing the same game, put out a mod, they'll play that mod. Now you've got that network, right?
So that's because, like, I had no idea about it at all.
Well, this is how League of Legends appeared. You know, it started as Dota, as a mod in Warcraft 3, and they literally, just took the exact mechanisms of Dota, because I think actually some of the Riot founders made Dota. Is that right?
I can't remember.
Or, like, they were involved in it somehow?
Ice Frog is the guy who made Dota.
Okay.
He's still one of the principal guys there. I'm not sure.
Okay. So, but yeah, I mean, they just sprung out of that. Yeah, they just took the exact mechanics. So like when you look at a screenshot of League of Legends and a screenshot of Warcraft 3, you're like, oh, like these are almost the same thing. And that was a very successful game that spawned an entirely now like one of the most popular PC games of all time. Right. So, you know, it all makes sense if you think about it.
Yeah, but it does make you wonder too. Every time you see a weird sort of seemingly random success story, you know, that feels out of nowhere.
Of course it's not.
It's not. It never is, right? There's either some dark broadcast going on. Actually, that's what has to happen, right?
Something that you don't know about or you're not clued into that was able to spread that message extremely effectively.
And this is why it's really hard if you're making and selling games or really anything. When you're trying to look at what other people have done, other successful people have done, and use it as a reference to figure out like what you should be doing.
It's what you can't see that matters.
Right. There's all this stuff you can't see even if you could see it, you wouldn't necessarily be able to understand what it did, right? Because even with us, we knew that we sent those 5 or 4,000 whatever emails to our B-Sketch ID users for Greenlight. But we don't know how many of those people acted on it. We don't know how much of it. Maybe none of them did. We have no idea. And so that's one of those things. There's an enormous asymmetry in information just all over the place anyway. But even people who have it can't actually know what it means.
right.
So it's a little tricky.
A little weird.
Yeah.
Yep.
You just got to do the best you can.
Find out those broadcasts.
And just stop tweeting so much because it's useless.
unless you're
being followed by Justin Bieber, in which case,
unless you're a broadcast network.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So let's get on to some questions. These questions come from podcast.bscotch.net. They're asked by our listeners. And if you want to get your question on a future podcast, head on over there and ask some good questions. All right. First question comes from Bytecode, who says, remember that pamphlet D&D? Me and another B-Scotch fan made it as a fan tribute. It's on the other side of the link. Hope you like. So a few episodes ago, we talked about Dungeons & Dragons and how it's awesome, except there's all these books. Like, there's all these things you have to know, and it's really hard to get started. And so we were joking about it would be great if there was a pamphlet tabletop game where you could just like get a single piece of paper, print on both sides. They would just have some real simple rules that anybody could use, and then just go from there. So a couple of our listeners, who is Bytecode and Nougat, they put together a sort of D&D-like tabletop game called Stickscape, and then they sent us a link to it, which is pretty hilarious. And they took like the lightweight thing really like to the max. So like they have a link to a player stat sheet template. Hold on, I'm gonna open this thing up. It's like it's like name, HP, gold, okay, mm-hmm. equipment, inventory, knowledge, and pet.
Good.
It's like that's all. Those are your stats. That's what you need.
I also like that all you need is to know things.
Yeah.
How much knowledge you have?
How much knowledge you got?
Yep. Knowledge is an important stat.
It's power, yeah. some would say.
Knowledge is power.
And of course, having a pet is also a power.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. So these guys, they linked to it in their questions. So over at podcast.bscotch.net, when the episode goes up, you'll be able to see the link to that. So if anybody wants to check that out, check it out. All right, next question comes from Cool Bloke 1306. Hello, coolest bloke. Men on the planet. That's a bit of a stretch.
A stretch, but how come he's a bloke? He gets to be a bloke, but we just have to be regular old men.
Yeah. What's that about?
He's a cool bloke.
We're cool men.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I feel like this is a little unfair.
Mm-hmm. There must be some kind of a third party that sort of allocates
bloke licensor.
Bloke licensor. Oh, yeah. And there's also probably a department of coolness who figures
that's
out.
That's true. Whether you're a bloke or a man.
Whether you're a bloke or a man, and then sort of where you land on the coolness spectrum.
Right. Everyone's got to draw a line. Yeah.
So we're going to probably have to make some phone calls and try to figure out.
It's kind of like getting your sort of verified Twitter account, you know? We need to get our verified blokeness. Bloke.
Is it a step below knighthood, you know?
Yeah. Being a bloke?
Being a bloke.
I think so.
Actually, it might be a step above. I think it's a step above.
Because you can get knighted. Can you get bloked?
You can get knighted, which makes you become a sir.
Right.
You know? And then you can get bloked.
I thought a bloke was just like somebody at a bar. That's like,
well, no, I'm pretty
you
sure.
You think so, but there's, you know.
It's like a hidden, it's a hidden broadcast network, you know? So,
yeah.
So actually they're far more powerful than knights.
Yes.
You know, but everybody kind of, they've done a good job of sort of Illuminati style, kind of just throwing the word around so that everybody feels like it doesn't mean anything.
So it's really it's the blokes that rule the world.
Yeah. So when you get knighted, they tap a sword on your shoulders.
Yeah.
When you get bloked, what's the ceremonial?
I think they just kind of pretend like the whole thing isn't even happening. So
they're so cool about it.
Yeah.
It's very chill.
I think actually they try to shake your hand and then you're supposed to take your hand away.
Oh, you like rub your hair back?
Exactly. Yeah. Because you're such a cool bloke.
You're too cool.
It's the ritual bloke handshake.
The question is, I just want to know, why did you start making games? Thanks.
Why did we start making games?
Because you wanted to.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's something. I think it was sort of pushed into existence from me sort Correct. Of at the outset. And it was something that I had always wanted to do. I think.
Yeah, actually, to be fair, I didn't want to make games and still don't.
Yeah.
That's not why I'm doing anything.
Yeah, dang Adam.
Adam doesn't make games. He makes all kinds of other
right.
Cool
I
shit.
Mean, if I wanted to make games, it would be a problem because I've got other shit that I have to do to make the game making as effective as possible. Go, right?
Yeah.
So I have to choose to not want it because it would be miswanting.
Yes. But yeah, this is something that we've touched on in previous episodes, but it's kind of the idea that if you're the kind of person who just really likes to learn stuff and pick up a lot of skills,
and then demonstrate them
and then use them for stuff.
Yeah.
Making games is one of those things that there's just sort of an endless well of interesting things that you can pick up to apply to it. So, but on the flip side of that, you don't get to hate things. Mm-hmm. Like if you say I hate drawing or I hate music or, you know, whatever,
or I hate math,
I hate marketing. Like you don't get to do that. If you want to make games and succeed at it, you have to just embrace everything. And that was kind of always the appeal to
it. Yeah. It's a field of endless challenge, I think. So it's kind of the fun part. You just get to do whatever you want.
Yeah. And every other
misery.
Yeah. And I think at the time I was going into finance and law and like MBA and stuff like that. And every single one of the things that I was studying just felt like a very narrowly defined set of issues. Right. And a very, very particular way of thinking about the world. And I couldn't quite see how, like, if I wanted to learn how to animate, if I wanted to learn how to edit, like, film, if I wanted to learn, like, software engineering or storytelling or whatever, I'm like, how's that going to play into my finance very much, right? And so it's just an open book. You can just do whatever you want with it, and it's just super cool.
Well, again, it's just the case that the interest for us, I think, comes from the fact that it allows us, it's basically the vehicle by which, it's like a really good cracker, okay?
Uh-huh. All right.
It's simply a vehicle by which you get to put whatever you want into your mouth.
Brie. Mostly brie, though.
Mostly brie. But, but I mean, anything. So game dev is just, it's just the best cracker because you can just put whatever you want.
So what's the apples? Brie in this metaphor, though? Because like maybe peanut butter apple is fine.
The brie is like, it's art. Sure. You know, and then you go put jam on there. That's like, that's some coding. Math,
yeah.
You know?
Okay. Sure, yeah.
You could put a sausage on there. You know, that's your... Uh-huh. That's your marketing.
Yeah.
Your marketing.
You might need a bigger cracker at some point, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
It's a vehicle. It's a vehicle for doing all sorts of weird stuff, which is fun.
Yeah. But it's interesting because people only think of the cracker when they think about making games. It's like, you know, you just want to eat a dry.
That's the most boring part.
You just want to eat just a dry cracker. You can put some awesome shit on that cracker.
Yeah. Like some brie, for example.
Put some brie on that. All right. So next question comes from French Toasty. How did you figure out how to program large maps or even just inventory systems? Did you come up with it yourself? A tutorial? Can you put up resources to help people who want to learn GML or not? Because competition. So we actually do have some tutorials. This question might be old. I don't know. So on our YouTube channel, we do have some videos of how to make games. Sam recorded some Inkscape stuff, and then
there's a problem with the XSplit broadcaster thing, basically, where it didn't show the menus.
Right. So Sam would be like, yeah, you're going to want to click on this menu and then click on this, and there's just nothing happening.
Which is also funny because I only do that because I'm teaching someone, because I just use hotkeys. So I'm never in menus.
Right.
So I did all this extra clicking around, and then it was invisible. So I got to do that again.
Yeah, so I mean, making tutorials is something that we are interested in and something that we are working on. To get more to the question of figuring out how to program large maps or inventory systems.
When he's talking about maps, I'm assuming he's talking about data structures.
No, I think probably like the world map, I would assume. So this I think we can dig a little deeper because on the surface level, the question is like specifics. Like, how do you make an inventory system? How do you figure out how to make a map or whatever? But I think there's an extra layer to this that we can dig into, which is just how do you figure things out, right? Yeah. Because if all we do is tell you, oh yeah, here's how you make an inventory system, well, that doesn't help you. We're just giving you a fish.
It'll help you for now.
You know, you gotta learn how to fish.
So how do you fish up an infinite world generation algorithm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is actually part of what Adam's talk is about.
Yep.
It's about sort of like, how do you come by knowledge and how do you actually do stuff with it?
How do you execute? How do you, Adam?
Turns out it's really complicated.
It's complicated. But I think the most important piece of advice for figuring out new things is to not care about finding the most perfect solution.
Or even a good one.
Just a solution.
Yeah.
Yep. And you can always go back and rework things after you learn more, because it's almost always the case.
But the key here is that you can't understand a problem until you've tried to solve it.
Yes.
And so you can't just have a problem and then have a solution. That's not how it works. You have to have a problem and then try to understand what the hell it is by working through it and trying to solve it.
So you're,
during which you'll inevitably find that you don't know what the hell it is, because that's the whole point. And then you'll learn something and you go back and start over. You know, it's an iterative process. So
you just keep doing that for a while.
Yeah.
And
it
so
can take a while.
The AI in our current game project is a perfect example, because our first version of the AI, which you can see in action in our Snuppy Rustling game on.
I wonder if that server's still running, actually.
I don't know.
I don't think I turned it
on. On our itch.io or bscotch.itch.io page, we have a bunch of our jam games up there, including Snuppy Rustling. The first version of that AI was, it would have 5 cards. It would just randomly pick one that it could afford, and then it would randomly throw its hammer, not trying to hit anything, not trying to accomplish anything. And this
just random
was pretty bad, but at the same time, sometimes it would hit your shit, and
it was occasionally startlingly accurate.
Yeah,
you'd have like, you just put a buddy down on your square, which is on the complete opposite side of the map from
just
it.
Boom, right in the
and
face.
And it would just,
so there's in principle like a 1 in 20 chance it's going to hit it.
But yeah.
But it does.
Yep. It does. And other times it just comes real close. And you're like, ooh,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's exciting. And so that was the first version. And again, that was like not trying to even solve the problem necessarily, but just It was the problem was
solving a different problem.
The problem was we don't have AI.
Correct.
Now we do.
Right.
It's really bad. It doesn't even try to win. And someone it behaves completely randomly.
It's not intelligence per se.
It is artificial though. The AI part.
Is it artificial intelligence or real dumbness?
Definitely we made a real dumb. A real dumb.
Yeah.
It's real dumb.
Yep. Yeah. RD algorithm.
We made a real dumbo. So then the next phase was as we started actually developing the game and getting a bunch of stuff in there, we realized we can't balance the game properly unless we're playing against an opponent who isn't a real dumbo.
Yep.
So
needs to be an artificial.
So then it was kind of the next draft where we came up with these kinds of like rules of thumb of what kinds of things we should tell the AI to keep an eye out for. So like if somebody captures your crystal, which is kind of like a flag and capture the flag. If an opponent or if one of your buddies has the opponent's crystal, then it'll try to hit it with the hammer, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll actually aim at things. But it's still the case that the AI was just trivially easy to defeat.
Mm-hmm. Well, because essentially what it was is we went from having random behaviors completely to a few rules that were just such blankets. It's almost like it's going down in terms of granularity, right? So we started with what is essentially
just wild
every
west. Case
is every option is available. Yeah. And then moving down from there, it was sometimes you should do one of these like five things. And that was better, but still really dumb most of the time.
Yeah.
And then from there is where we finally move to, which is depending on what the things are that you have.
Which is context dependent decision making.
Pick the correct one.
So now the AI looks at the situation around it. It looks at what its different options are and it gives each option a score based on how effective it thinks that's going to be. And then it takes the highest score thing and just does that thing. And so, so again, it's not going to always do the best thing. In fact, there's no way to actually know what the best thing even is because like, if you think about in a chess game, for example, there are more combinations of moves than there are atoms in the universe, right? Because there's just so fucking many things you can do. And so you can't use, there's not enough computing power to sort of simulate every conceivable possible outcome from where you're at till the end of the game. And so, instead you just kind of come up with some good rules and then you do it. Right. And so this was kind of our process of answering the AI question. And even though we've been making games for half a decade now, the question of how do you make an AI in a strategy game? We're just like, I don't know, literally don't know. So just start ham-fisting things in there.
Yeah, you start with something that does solve the problem, which in the case of us,
and that it does something.
It was just having an opponent, an actual opponent to play against, which could be completely random. So you just start there and then you add more layers to it as you go.
Yeah. So in this case, you're building an inventory system. Mm-hmm. Like what's an inventory? Just a bunch of stuff. How do you have a bunch of stuff? Put it in a list. Done. Now you've got a shitty start up inventory system, right?
And it turns out that's what we ended with too. Right. Because an inventory is just a list of what you have.
Yeah, but then a bunch of questions will stem from this as you start to implement it. Because now you'll be like, okay, so my inventory is just a list of stuff, but then how do I remove something out of it, right? How do I find something? How do I show
a slot that only holds weapons, for example?
Right. Then what does that mean? Do I need a new list? You know, so basically once you just go down a path. You don't have a plan, you don't have a solution in its entirety. The solution builds itself as you start to uncover the sub problems. Mm-hmm. Because I think the thing that people often that makes problem solving so difficult and decision making so difficult that people often fail to realize is that you're not setting out to solve the big problem ever because you can't. It's literally impossible. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is you have a goal. You have a goal that is a collection of problems that we all just call the problem, right? But you have a goal that's a collection of problems. Most of those problems that you don't even know they exist yet. Mm-hmm. It's just fog. It's just fog, right? So you're not actually solving a problem. You're wading through fog. And what you're trying to do as you're doing that is then stumble across all these actual problems that need to be solved. These little one-off individual problems where each one of those reveals something new, right?
I feel like fog is such a perfect metaphor for this because in a fog, you can actually see perfectly well, but real just close. like real close, right around you.
Right.
And then as soon as you try to look farther out, you're just like, well, I have no fucking
idea. You're basically in a fog of parts building.
But here's the thing. How do you find out what's out there? You walk over there.
Yeah, you gotta go.
Right. You gotta do something. You can't just stand in one place and be like, oh, I don't know what's over there. And just fucking stand there forever, right? You'll never know what's over there.
Yep.
Damn, man. So good.
Metaphors. Okay.
Metaphors. So yeah, you just gotta wade through the fog. So in other words, for our large maps though, Perlin Noise inventory system is a list. All right. So next question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. You were always saying that free mobile games are bad. What are your opinions/experience about free Steam games?
I don't play any of them, and I reject them out of hand when I see them.
So
I don't have any.
So I played
except for Alien Swarm.
Yeah,
so that's just a free game.
That was totally free. So there's a few. So I think interesting point here is that the general is understanding the reason why we generally say that free games are bad on mobile.
Right. So it's not because they are free mobile games.
Correct. And it's not because they're mobile, and it's not because they're free.
Yes.
And it's not all of them.
Correct.
It's the other thing.
Yes. Which is
it's the gross part.
The generally gross practices that come with how you actually do make money off of a game that you're giving away to people. So so just to get that out of the way first, because there are a couple free to play games on mobile that are totally fun to play, believe it or not. And like they don't feel disgusting to play. Mm-hmm. Even something like Crossy Road.
Quadrupus Rampage is
right, that's a good one.
One that comes to mind.
But even something like Crossy Road where they're like, hey, if you watch this ad, we'll just pay you some in-game money. Mm-hmm. I'm like, sure, thanks for the choice.
Right. It's a very understandable
right.
transaction where it feels like you're still basically actually just paying for something.
Right.
Yeah.
So like that's sort of stuff I'm fine with. When we talk about gross stuff, it's usually on the
timers.
Yeah, timers, just sort of all sorts of weird stuff that energy really are about units. Breaking gameplay.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as Steam free games, I think Warframe is just the best example of like just a best in class.
Yeah, Warframe.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So good. It really
Space fun. Ninjas.
It feels so good to play. And it is totally free. So
yeah.
Like all of it. And you of course.
I found it aggravating because I wanted to pay them stuff, right. but like to actually get like all the things it would literally cost like $4,000.
Yeah, but here's the one
which again, the funny thing it gets like, gross again because of the how things are priced. But
the thing is you could still just get all that stuff just by playing, right?
Oh yeah, after a few thousand after hours of playing.
About 90,000 hours. But yeah. I think there's I bought some stuff in Warframe because I was like, this game's awesome. It's amazing. I want to support this game. So I threw down like $20 and I got
I did the same.
Whatever their shit is that you get.
It's platinum?
Platinum?
Something.
Corbels? I don't know.
Everyone's got their own metal.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So I bought a bunch of Corbel orbs and then I got like I was looking through the list of weapons and stuff and like all the different shit, what are they called? Just Warframes, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like your torso, your body.
Yeah.
So I got a new body and I was so pumped and I was looking at all the stats on it. And then I went to play with it and it was just bad. Right. And I was like, fuck, I just bought like a whole suite of terrible weapons and a really shitty.
Well, so this is the weird place that it gets put.
So I just went back to my normal.
It's right. just like, yeah, it's like buying anything, right? If you can't see what it is first, then it's just a gamble.
I'm not sure if they do now, but they did not have a preview option at the time. I don't know if you saw it. They announced that they're having an open world, like a more like an MMO style thing. There's a few of those that are opening up. It's like 40 people per, and it's called like the Plains of Eidolon or something like that. Looks pretty neat. Looks pretty dope. Got to hop in there again. But this is an interesting point, which is that in a game where they're trying to be good stewards of their community in terms of like how they do the free to play stuff, this is actually one of the weird problems that comes up, which is that they are clearly trying to do a good job making sure that if you pay for something, you're not just like winning, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem is then
sort of did the opposite.
Well, but the reality is that everything then has to become a side grade in a lot of ways where it's sort of like, it's more like just fitting your play style or doing fun things or looking super cool or whatever. So that's, I think, one of the interesting weird tension points where it ends up being, if they do free to play really, really well, in terms of not doing some of the weirder, grosser stuff, it actually becomes harder to make the purchases feel good.
Well, then you got also problems with things like Guild Wars 2, where this is an MMO. I don't know if it's still the case, but when it came out, you had to buy the game just up front, period. Yeah.
But there's no subscription cost.
Right. And that was their big angle. They're like, it's a full on MMO, like the size of something like, wow, you know, it's crazy. There's all this stuff. And it's true. Like it's a huge game. It's very awesome. Deep. Yeah. It's very beautiful. Complex.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful music, beautiful scenery and no subscription.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their angle. It's the MMO that you don't have to pay a subscription for. But instead they have, you keep getting these chests that you can't open without keys that you pay like a dollar or two for. And they're full of just all kinds
of... It's sort of like my feeling with Warframe. It's like surprisingly expensive given how frequently you would want to do it.
Yeah. Right. So like if you wanted to open all these chests you got, you'd be paying way more than a subscription. $15
a month. Right?
And, this is something that it bothers me because I will happily pay a subscription for an amazing game. And I do that regularly, right? Like I did play World of Warcraft forever, and people are like, oh, subscription model is dying. Well, I mean, I still have a subscription for EVE Online and like, you know, stuff like that. So, I think people just want to enjoy a good game, you know, and not be harassed all the time.
this is the weird territory.
That's why I reject them all out of hand is because I just assume that my best case scenario with a free-to-play game almost across the board is that if I'm lucky that it's good and I like it, at some point it's going to get gross. And now I just have to not play it anymore and basically now be upset that I had a good experience that has now been ruined by some gross practice when all I want to do is just be able to buy the thing, right? And there have been a handful of games because Steam's now a few more have been released of various kind of free to play style games. It's quite possible that some of them have good systems in place, but we also just know from thinking about the market so much just how hard it is to have a successful free to play model that isn't gross.
Right.
It's very hard, and so it's a fair assumption that if you play a game that is free to play, it's either gross or it's going to disintegrate.
In what sense?
As in like the player, so take like Tribes, right? Really good pay system in terms of being fair to players, right? But then also disintegrates over time, right? Guild Wars actually like is having really, has a lot of trouble maintaining a player base. And I think, I think it's just very hard. It's very hard to actually make enough money to support the production of a game unless you get gross.
Well, I also think when I'm playing a game, I want to be immersed. Like I want to go into the game world and focus on the challenges and interesting stuff that the game is presenting. I don't want one of those challenges to be me thinking about my own personal bank account, and whether or not I should tap into that.
I mean, Rocket League started doing this too, because they give you chests and then they're like, oh, I have the keys. You can buy a key for like a buck. And I did it the first time. And then I was like, why?
Yeah, because what they were doing was they were selling cars, and I bought them all.
Yeah.
They're like $2 a piece.
Well, they still do that, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, fuck yeah, like I want to support this game more. These are great things, and I bought them. And now I can't actually buy the things I want. Now I have to gamble. Yeah, I got to buy a key and open a chest, and I'm like, ah, shit, I didn't get the thing I wanted. Right. Maybe I'll spend another $5. No, like I'm just not going to do it.
But I think the fact that it has become because it is weird that gambling is now one of these common strategies that games use. Because Borderlands does it as well, right? Which is again
League edited in as well. Yep. Everyone's got their chest and key system. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck happened.
What happened is gambling, and gambling is addictive, and it's really effective at getting people to spend money.
Well, and it's also the case that you know there's a lot of research around this issue, but that you know in a free to play game, most of your money comes from 1% of your players. Mm-hmm. And really, most of your money comes from 1% of those players, right? So like 80% of your money comes from that tiny sliver. And if your game allows, like has these kinds of things in it with like these gambling mechanisms for real money, you know, what you're doing is you're tapping into people with problems, like people with compulsive gambling addiction issues who are really susceptible to this kind of stuff.
Here's the question though. Is it possible for someone to, for example, playing Warframe or Hearthstone or whatever else, to spend the however much money it actually costs to get everything in the game, and for you to not consider that necessarily as like some sort of gross.
I would expense. Well, here's the thing: the game actually like pushes against that because, like in Warframe, if you bought every Warframe,
you still and every weapon,
you still have to level them up. You still have to, and you can only play one of them at a time. Right. It's not like you just have that,
right?
But I don't know. I feel like there's a pretty sharp distinction between like giving somebody a decision to buy something, like in Rocket League, they release a car and you're like, do you want to buy this car?
Or yes or no. You're like, I'm going to buy this frame.
Yeah. Right. Versus.
There might be something awesome in here. Maybe not.
Maybe not. And they're like, they even do stuff like in Rocket League, they even do the stuff like they'll show the list of cool things you can get.
Oh, it's a roulette wheel.
And then, well, then at the very end of it, there's a mystery item. Like there's a mystery skin or whatever, and they just show like a car with like a tarp over it, you know, and it's like, what is it? You know, so they
it's like double gambling.
Yeah. And so I feel like this is the kind of stuff that actually pushes people out of gaming. And I think one of the best examples in recent memory is in World of Warcraft, Warlords of Draenor, which was the 2 expansions ago. Currently they're on Legion, so it was, I guess, the previous expansion. The player base was getting really frustrated because there was no new sort of, like, in-game content that people could do, because people love to go out and, like, accomplish things in the game to get, like, a cool mount or something like that, because it's kind of like a walking trophy that you can ride around. And Blizzard kept releasing boars and wolves, and they would just like recolor the boar and recolor the wolf over and over and over again, and just keep re-releasing these as rewards for like we released this new raid boss and you get the orange boar for killing it, right? And everybody's like, come on. And then finally,
give me a scorpion.
Finally, they released a new mount and you couldn't get it in the game. You just paid $20 for it. And people were so fucking mad. Like you can go and you can find on their YouTube channel, you can find that video because they made a trailer for the mount because they were trying to sell it, right? So they made a trailer for the mount talking about it. They got their normal voiceover guy who does like the voiceovers for like the in-game cinematics, right, and stuff. And the like dislike bar on that video is so heavily skewed. It's like 90% red, you know? And all the comments are people who are just really mad because they wanted something to
go work
They wanted
on.
Something to go into the game and do. And instead they're supposed to just hand over $20 and just have it.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it just misses the question. Like, why are people playing these games?
Right.
To do cool stuff. It's not to have a thing. It's to earn a thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Which in short, I think free to play is almost always gross.
It's hard. it puts you as a developer in such a weird bind, right? For all those things we talked about. Because if you want to do something that doesn't feel like a weird, pay to win sort of scenario, then inevitably everybody buys is a side grade.
Yeah. I mean, the game is now part of your business instead of a product your business made.
Right.
Right. And so now all the rules that apply to like, how do you run a business effectively? How do we make sure we have enough money? How do we do it? Like now all of a sudden everything is on the table. So if your business is struggling, you can say, what if we change the game so that now people can gamble inside of it? Right.
Right.
Because it's now just an extension of your business decisions. Right. And I think, all it takes now is a change in management or selling the company or you about to be bankrupt or whatever. And all of a sudden this thing that you've made that doesn't feel gross now just gets to feel gross. Right.
An interesting side effect of the Rocket League gambling. They added gambling and they added trading, right? So you can trade items and keys and stuff.
Right.
So before you had the problem of you'd go into a 3v3 match or whatever, and if your team started losing, your teammates would just leave, right? And so every match became just a revolving door because for some reason people don't want to play, they just want to win. Right. And so now you have that, and then compounded on top of that, you have people who come into your match and they go, hey, anybody want to trade? We want to trade?
And then you're like, there's no lobby outside of
it. Right. There's nowhere else. And then you're just like, no. And then like, eh, and then they just leave. Right. So people just dive into random like five or like 3v3 or 4v4 games, try to find people to trade with. They aren't playing. They just sit there in their car just like asking people to trade shit. And then when nobody wants to trade, they just abandon their team. Right. So as much as I have loved Rocket League in the past, like this suite of changes has unilaterally made the game way worse than it was before. So it's terrible.
It's hard to not have it be gross. And again, like, even if you have the best of intentions, you're like, we're trying not to have a subscription. We want to make the game available to people. We want to make it so that only people
Rocket League.
There are lots of good rationales, I think, for a business person to think like, I'm going to try to make an ethical, free to play
model.
I just think there's almost no way to do it that doesn't also make the game less good than it could be. And the number of incentives for you to then continue to make it worse is enormous, because if you don't make enough money, well, then you got to start tweaking that stuff. Mm-hmm. If you make a bunch of money, ooh, you can make more, So I think all the incentives are bad across the board.
Yeah. And on top of this mount thing that Blizzard did, that was also the moment where their subscriber base kept plummeting and plummeting and plummeting. At a certain point, it dropped so low that it was lower than it was in 2004.
Right.
Like when the game came out.
Yeah.
And so then they stopped reporting subscriber numbers period. So they're a publicly traded company. So they were supposed to be reporting this stuff because that was one of their metrics for the health of their game. And then at that moment, they released a statement. They said, we're going to stop releasing subscriber numbers. Instead, we're only going to be talking about revenue because it turns out our revenue is still great. They're right. Because it turns out that the people who are still around,
it's the free to play model,
are just willing to pay a lot more money.
Right.
Yeah. And so now they're like, we're going to, and then they, in their statement, they announced, we're going to be focusing a lot more on selling things like mounts and, all these other extra services on top of the subscription. So it really comes down to our game is dying. So instead of resuscitating it, we're just going to sort of like wring it out like a sponge. Like you said, once the option is on the table to do that, then that's
you can't put the genie back in.
Yeah, that's the quickest, shortest way to
pass.
Ah, All right. Well,
that's all.
Yeah. Which is all to say, that's all. I skip them all and I don't even worry about it.
Gotta skip them all.
Yeah, gotta skip them all.
All right.
Pay money or go home.
So that's all the time we have for this week. Sorry, we kind of flew off the rails there at the last 10 minutes, but I think it was good. It was good.
Mm-hmm. Good real
free to play always brings out the worst in everybody. Have you ever had a discussion about free to play, even with like the most sensible? Like,
I haven't had one where even I was with, like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. That's yeah. fair.
Because yeah. nobody loves it, but some people are like, I can see how this is acceptable, right?
People begrudgingly accept it or they just hate it.
Right. And even those people who love it, they love the free part, but not anything else about what's happening. That's right. True. So yeah, I think it's just,
well, because I know, like, for example, Apple and I think Google as well got sued a bunch in Europe because everything was marked as free, but then once you have it, then you could in theory spend hundreds of thousands of dollars inside the game. So like you can't call it free. Like you can't, you have to say get, you're going to get this game. Anyways. All right, so that's all the time we have. We'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, for putting this episode together, our producer, Fat Barb, for making us sound good and for drilling a board onto our shelf to keep us from slapping our mics. We'd also like to thank the B-Scotch dev team, Andy, Tifa, and Shure, for continuing to build stuff, and a special thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And, of course, we'd like to thank our listeners for coming back every week to listen to us. And if you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can hop into our Discord server at bit.ly/BSDiscord. Come say hi. And we have a mailbox if you want to send us candy or Red Bull, basically those two things. head on over to mailbox.bscotch.net. We have our address up there, and you can just, do it. Well, we get an alert whenever stuff comes in. So, even if it's sort of a semi-perishable thing, chances are we'll
get it in time.
We'll get it before it turns into a rotten.
But it definitely shouldn't be like full on perishable.
It shouldn't be like an apple.
Yeah. Or live animal.
It definitely should be live.
Yeah. Keep your live animals. Just
make
to
sure
yourself.
You poke holes in its back so it can breathe. All right. So, we don't advertise this show. We do depend completely on word of mouth and good reviews. So if you want to help us grow the show, please tell your friends, hit up Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast and give us some 5-star reviews, say some comments, talk about, all the cool shit.
Which, after talking about virality, maybe just don't do that. Just send a note to Justin Bieber.
Just send a note to Justin Bieber and tell Justin Bieber to start listening to this podcast.
Find all the biggest broadcasters you know.
Bother them.
Tell them all about it.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Don't fucking bother leaving us.
Actually, at the end of every podcast, they're like, that's how new listeners find us.
That's not true at all.
Apple reviews, but that can't be true.
All right, we're going to update this last portion. All right, so listen, we don't advertise this show, so we depend completely on you tweeting directly at Kim Kardashian, Justin Bieber, Kanye West, Ellen.
Who else? Yep. Ellen, she's real big.
Mm-hmm. Oprah.
Love Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Barack Obama.
Yeah. Markiplier, I don't know.
Markiplier. So just...
anybody you know who knows like a million people,
just tweet at them, send them an email, try to like figure out where they frequent. Mm-hmm. Go to the bar.
Don't do that. Nope.
Go to the bar, buy them a drink.
Reel that back. Reel that all the way back. Yeah, we will not
learn all their habits.
Nope. We're not going to. Nope. Don't do any of these things.
Get a restraining
order.
We'll
do all the other ones, but don't do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
none of the in-person stuff.
And that's how we grow the podcast. So we're going to just be doing that in the future. So thank you all very much for listening. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.